Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner, National Union Fire Insurance Company versus Lerma. Court is allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Gutierrez. My name is Frank Bettis with the firm of Royston, Razor, Vickery & Williams here for National Union Fire Insurance Company. The main issue before the court this morning is the definition of total and permanent incapacity. This is a workers' compensation case that was tried in Zapata, Texas, went through the Court of Appeals, and is now before the court basically on that issue. It's our position that if the trial court's action, if the Court of Appeals affirming the trial court's action is upheld, then what in effect has happened is that the definition in this case of total and permanent incapacity would be that a worker, Mr. Lederman in this case, is unable to perform the usual tasks of an oil field worker, a roughneck in particular. There is no evidence in this record that Mr. Lerma cannot perform the usual tasks of a worker, of a workman in general. There is no evidence that Mr. Lerma cannot get and keep employment. We have no argument with the actual definition of total and permanent incapacity that was given to the jury. It was taken out of the pattern jury charge, apparently, and it is correct. And that is, total incapacity does not mean absolute inability to perform any kind of labor, but means that a person is disabled from performing the usual tasks of a worker, not merely the usual tasks of any particular trade or occupation, to such an extent that he cannot get and keep employment. And my argument this morning, I would like to focus on the last two phrases of that definition. First, the phrase, not merely the usual tasks of any particular trade or occupation. The trial evidence in this case is that Mr. Lerma can go back to work. In fact, the trial evidence in this case is that he did go back to work. Mr. Lerma himself testified that he cannot perform the usual tasks of an oil field worker. Yet he never testified that he cannot get and keep employment or that he cannot perform the usual tasks of a worker. Mr. Lerma's co-worker, Mr. Rocha, also testified that Mr. Lerma could not perform heavy manual labor in the oil fields. But he did not testify that he cannot perform the usual tasks of a worker. Mr. Rocha did come very close to testifying that Mr. Lerma cannot perform the tasks of a worker. He apparently had some, the record will reflect that he apparently had some difficulty understanding one question, and he asked counsel, he asked Mr. Gutierrez, something to the effect of, are you asking me if he can work, referring to Mr. Lerma, to which Mr. Rocha replied, no, he can't work. But in cross-examination, it was made very clear that Mr. Rocha did not see Mr. Lerma from the date of the accident to the date of trial, and he admitted unequivocally that he did not know what Mr. Lerma could or could not do. So thus far, given the evidence of Mr. Lerma and of Mr. Rocha, we still have no evidence that Mr. Lerma cannot perform the usual tasks of a worker in general, or that he cannot get or keep employment. Mr. Lerma himself admitted that he applied for unemployment compensation benefits from December of 86 through July of 1987. And specifically, the records will reflect that Mr. Lerma admitted that he signed the application for unemployment benefits, that he was able and available for work. On direct examination, he went so far as to admit that all the statements in those applications were true. In other words, that it was true that he was able and available for work. After unemployment benefits were terminated, Mr. Lerma actually obtained work. He obtained work for a one-month period, and it's important to note that it's important to note that his employment was not terminated because of any physical disability or inability to do the work. It terminated because this particular job was temporary, and it was going to terminate. After the termination of this employment, he no longer sought work. There are cases to the effect that...
Counselor, you don't have much time. Are you going to argue about the lump sum payment issue that he granted on?
Yes, Your Honor. The lump sum issue, Your Honor, basically, we take issue with that because there was no evidence, in our opinion, there was no jury issue, and there was no finding by the jury of manifest hardship. And the cases of TEIA versus Motley, 491 Southwest 2nd, 395, a Texas Supreme Court case, 1973, and the case of Atwine versus Dallas Independent School District, 698 Southwest 2nd, 226, a Court of Appeals case out of Dallas, specifically require that a finding be made of manifest hardship in order for there to be a finding that a lump sum payment is required. In this case, there was no such finding. The trial court, in its judgment, apparently impliedly found that there was hardship based on the evidence that it heard. However, Rule 279, the basis for that finding, cannot be resorted to in this particular case because the ground of recovery, in this case, lump sum, has only one issue, manifest hardship. And Rule 279 only kicks in, is only applicable if there are two or more grounds for recovery, one of which is found by the jury.
Why isn't lump sum recovery just part of the workers' compensation action?
Because it doesn't follow specifically from finding that the man was either incapacitated or finding his average weekly wage. It doesn't follow that he's automatically entitled to lump sum. He must plead it, prove it, and obtain the necessary findings.
It doesn't follow from the fact that he was injured on the job that he is entitled to cover any particular level of benefits. But wouldn't you say that the weekly rate wage is certainly referable to the question about were you injured on the job?
The weekly rate wage, yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that.
And so why isn't the manner of payment also directly related to the injury on the job issue?
Because that's a totally separate issue of just because I think the distinction that I would make is you may be entitled to it, but you don't necessarily have to ask for it. Now, when you go through a workers' compensation case, what you essentially do is you find total and permanent incapacity, or you find partial incapacity. But that's not going to do the worker any good unless they also find the wage rate, the applicable wage rate. Once you get those two elements, then you have a total recovery. Now, the law also provides for, in certain circumstances, that you get that recovery in a lump sum. And you can assert that right if you feel you're deserving of it. But it doesn't follow that you either have to assert that right or that a judgment which does not call for lump sum payment is somehow incomplete. And that's why I feel that they're separable issues.
Would a claim for unpaid medical benefits also be a separate ground of recovery, or would it be directly referable to the question about injury on the job?
I think it would be a separable issue, Your Honor. I think the worker could bring a separate action in the district court for unpaid medical benefits.
But he still has to show injury on the job.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you're saying that the weekly wage rate is directly referable, but medical benefits and lump sum is not.
I'm simply stating that because I did read some cases, and cite I cannot give you, in which a lawsuit was brought strictly for the medical benefits under Section 7 of 8306. The evidence that was adduced at trial, and I'd like to get back to the total and permanent incapacity issue, Dr. Swan was called, Dr. William Swan of Corpus Christi was called as an expert. But the questions posed to Dr. Swan were again specifically geared towards whether this man was able to work as an oil field worker. And Dr. Swan said no, because he cannot do heavy manual labor. Dr. Swan was well aware of the fact that Mr. Ledma was working during the period that Dr. Swan was treating him. Dr. Swan also makes specific note that yes, Mr. Ledma can perform some jobs, and he makes specific note also of the fact that Dr. Michael Galo of Laredo, Texas, had said that Mr. Ledema could go back to work, and he encouraged him to do so. The evidence in this case does not show that Mr. Ledema cannot perform the tasks of a workman in general. The evidence in this case shows that Mr. Ledema cannot perform the tasks of an oil field worker. However, the definition of total and permanent incapacity is not limited to someone who can do the work of a particular trade or occupation. And the Supreme Court, in TEIA versus Hawkins, 396 Southwest 2nd 305, and TEIA versus Mallard, 182 Southwest 2nd 1000, has specifically addressed that issue. The court has not narrowed the definition of total and permanent incapacity to such an extent that someone who cannot perform the work that he was performing before, or who cannot perform the work of a particular trade or occupation, encompasses or comes under the definition of total and permanent incapacity.
So if a piano player loses a finger, they're not totally permanently disabled.
The case that is cited by the appellee, the Glover case, deals with similar facts. It was an injury to a hand, and the court set forth specifically the facts of that case, which included that the man could not perform the job that he had before, which was driving a truck. He could not tie down the loads. He could not maneuver his truck. Now, that evidence alone, in conjunction with the definition of total and permanent incapacity, would suggest that we are narrowing the definition too much. But there was also evidence, specific evidence in that case, that the man couldn't cast a rod and reel. And the doctor specifically stated, this man, his hand is totally incapacitated. The hand was useless in effect, and the court so found. But that's a different situation from saying the hand is useless, therefore the body is useless. All the evidence in this case, or none of the evidence in this case, will indicate that Mr. Letterman's body is useless. The cases that say
what
kind
that... What injury was involved here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What kind of injury was involved here?
He had a... It was a back strain that doctors...
A general injury?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. It was a back strain. Dr. Swan diagnosed it as a back strain. Lumbosacral. The cases that state that an employee or a worker can go back to work and still be found totally and permanently incapacitated are distinguishable from this case. In those cases, there's two important things that always arise. One, there's evidence, direct evidence either from the employee himself or from the doctors, that the injury is incapacitating in general. Not just he can't go back to his usual work, but it's incapacitating in general. And two, there's almost always direct and uncontroverted evidence that the employee went back to work for economic reasons. In this case, we don't have those two elements. In this case, the evidence stops at a point where the witnesses state this man cannot go back to work as an oil field worker. There is no evidence that he went back to work because of economic necessity, or that the injury itself is incapacitating to him, other than preventing him from working as an oil field worker. And for that reason, I think those cases which the appellee cites are basically distinguishable from the case that we have here. That's all I have, Your Honor, if there's any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, sir.
May I be seated?
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Baldwin Gutierrez, will be the argument from respondent.
May it please the court, counsel for the petitioner. I will just pass very briefly on the question of total incapacity. I believe the petitioner is basically asking the court to reverse those rulings that allow a worker to continue working and still be allowed to be found under the definition of total incapacity, under the workers' compact, to be totally incapacitated. And there's several cases that have shown individuals that continue working, and we still have findings of total incapacity. This particular case, we have an oil field worker who was injured, sustained a back injury, sustained a general injury, and the jury, after they listened to the evidence, found that he was totally incapacitated and found that he was incapacitated within the definition that that was used in this particular case, which is the definition that comes under the Workers' Compact. Plenty of evidence. I felt that the argument was going to be that perhaps the Court of Appeals had used the wrong method on how to arrive at sustaining the trial court's judgment and the jury's answers as to why this man was solely incapacitated. And I was prepared to say that the Court of Appeals, as I understood the opinion, was that they simply saw the record and found that the jury, in deciding the duration and the extent of injury, had used their own assessment of the case, their own assessment of the facts, which is completely proper under the Reyna case, which was decided by the Supreme Court. With respect to lump sum, my argument to the Court of Appeals was that this lump sum requirement, this argument and the case law that I believe, and we will not certainly disagree that there is no case law, but the case law that says that a worker is required to submit an issue on hardship is no, I can't find it within the scheme of the Workers' Compact, and I can't seem to find it in the intent of the legislature that made the law for the injured worker, and that is that when he goes to trial, in addition to proving that he's totally and permanently incapacitated, in order to get his benefits, when a jury says that he is completely disabled, that he is totally incapacitated, and I should stick to the word of totally incapacitated, that he still needs to prove that unless they pay him today, you know, when the judgment is rendered, there will be some hardship. The Committee on Pattern Jury Charges, in fact, points out to the same article that I used in my brief, and that's 8306, Section 15A.
Do they cite to Texas Employers Association of Motley?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do they cite the Pattern Jury Charge or your brief cite to Texas Employers Association of Motley?
No, Your Honor. They do not.
Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm familiar that this court decided the case, Your Honor, and that in that particular case.
And it's in the Court of Appeals opinion, in direct conflict with this Supreme Court opinion.
In direct conflict with Motley?
Yes.
The Court of Appeals decision in this case is in direct conflict. Yes, Your Honor.
Therefore, you lose.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying and what I'm trying to point out to the court is that this decision of the Court of Appeals based its ruling on the Act, on 8306 Section 15, and that there is discretion on the trial court to award lump sum to the injured worker in the absence of a submitted issue.
So Motley was incorrectly decided.
Yes, Your Honor. In all due respect to the court, am saying that Motley was incorrectly decided. And the only example I can use, that I believe it was in Motley, Your Honor, that the Supreme Court shows
to allow discretion to award lump sum attorney's fees. And I cannot distinguish why should the attorney, why should I be entitled to lump sum attorney's fees if I didn't submit an issue for my client on hardship and he is allowed a weekly amount of benefits.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that you can't have a deemed binding unless there's another referable issue that goes with that particular ground of recovery or defense?
It was my, and it is my understanding of the rules, Your Honor, that the court can deem admitted certain issues that are not, or that are omitted. You know,
I'm asking you, though, don't you agree with his assessment that it has to go with a finding that the jury made in order to have a deemed finding? As part of a brace of two issues, for example, whereas this is just a single issue.
I'm sorry. We had an omitted issue on wage rate, for example, and we have an admitted issue on hardship. My position is that the court can deem admitted, for example, wage rate as they did here, because there was no objection. There was no objection to us not submitting hardship. But what I would say is that going back to the Motley case, that our position is that it was incorrectly decided, number one, and that even if they had objected to it, the fact that we didn't submit it and didn't submit it, I would still stand by the Court of Appeals' opinion that hardship is discretionary and should be discretionary with the court in awarding benefits, the complete benefits to the worker once the jury decides that an injured worker is totally and permanently incapacitated. This might not be the case if a jury would award temporary benefits, or if an injured worker is what we call temporarily disabled during the time that the board has jurisdiction of the claim. I'm talking about the Industrial Action Board. Now, it's certainly understandable that when a person is temporarily disabled, what we call TTD or temporary totally disabled, that no, you don't award lump sum awards because you don't know if this man is going to be released a week or a month from now. But when you have a finding that this man is totally and permanently incapacitated, I'm just saying that to take away discretion from the courts or not give discretion to the courts would be an injustice to the worker, and I think would be really in violation of the Act and not what the founders and the makers of this Act were intending for this benefits to provide for the worker. And I'm sorry.
One more question, and that is, do you agree or disagree with the statement of opposing counsel that there is no evidence that he could no longer perform the usual task of a workman, but rather the evidence was limited to he can no longer perform the usual tasks of an oil field worker?
Well, Dr. William Swan testified on page 62, and it's page 62 of the record, that he could not do any work involving heavy lifting, bending, stooping, whether in the oil field or in any other type of work. That's the only thing, you know, I have that, and plus we have Mr. Olivero Rocha, who was a driller and roughneck, and who had many years' experience, said that this man was not employable. And then we have even the petitioner's doctor, Dr. Galo, saying that this man probably could not go back to do this type of work. So if we're going to go into that, then certainly we would be overruling a lot of cases which have shown that individuals are able to do some work. Now, the jury, obviously, in their argument, in my closing argument, I'm assuming that I probably impressed on them that they can find that a worker has worked or can work, and they can still find him total and permanent incapacitated, because that's been my understanding of the law, and I think that is what has happened in this case. But there's ample evidence this man was not capable of performing ordinary work tasks. We've never submitted the definition of worker and what a worker and what ordinary tasks of a worker are. This is something that, again, going back to Reyna, the case of Reyna, is something the jury's just going to have to take from the instructions that they receive.
But your question was phrased in the sense that he can no longer do the usual tasks of a workman, and not just that he can't do the usual tasks of all of the work.
I phrased the question of whether or not he could do the ordinary tasks of the worker several times. I believe I asked Dr. Swan that at one time. In fact, I think Dr. Swan actually corrected me when I tried to limit his scope of his opinion with respect to oil field worker. He said, not only oil field worker, but any work. And I'm just quoting directly from the record where I asked him that. He says, And what is that opinion? Is that Mr. Lerma cannot return to those duties, which I understand is heavy lifting, bending, stooping, whether it be in the oil field or in any other type of work. And with respect to lump sum, I was trying also to try to distinguish the difference from lump sum awards in, for example, fatal injury claims, when there's no controversy, how it is certainly, it would be very impermissible to try to award or the court to award a discretionary award in a lump sum when you have something that's so speculative and so hard to calculate, when you have a widow and her children asking for death benefits. And that's why the statute says, you know, it's got to be on a weekly basis as opposed to a lump sum, unless there's an actual controversy. And if there's a controversy, then there's a scheme within the Act on how we try to calculate a judgment, or how we try to calculate the basis of trying to evaluate a fatal injury claim. But I have just tried to distinguish that again, Motley, all due respect to the court, I think has been decided wrong because of what the statute has announced and what the intention of the legislature was in providing benefits to the injured worker, an injured worker who has lost his rights at common law. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Can I proceed? I'd like to take up a couple of the points that Mr. Gutierrez addressed. It's not our position, and we're not asking the court to reverse those opinions that hold that that just because a worker does return to work, that he cannot be found totally and permanently incapacitated. What I am asking the court to do is to see the distinction between the evidence presented in those types of cases and the evidence presented in this case. And
are you taking a position this is a no evidence case or an insufficient evidence?
No evidence case, Your Honor.
A no evidence case.
Yes, Your Honor. The two...
Do you dispute your opposition to the recollection of the record that both the doctor and the supervisor testified that this incapacity was that of an ordinary worker?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. I do dispute that. I do take issue with that, which I wish to address in a few seconds. The two distinguishing factors between those types of cases and this case is, in the cases that hold that a worker can go back to work and yet be found totally and permanently incapacitated, number one, there was direct evidence that the injury itself was incapacitating. The injury was generally incapacitating, and not just incapacitating to that person for the type of work he was performing before, but incapacitating in general, flat out incapacitating.
Can you think of a more incapacitating injury than an injury to the back, the general body?
Yes, Your Honor, I can think of a more incapacitating injury than the injury that this man sustained.
Oh, I'm talking about the result of the accident that produced the injury to his back. Is that correct?
I don't quite understand the question, sorry.
Was the injury to his back?
What, can I think of a more incapacitating injury?
An injury to the back of a worker.
It depends on the type of injury to the back. This man did have pre-existing conditions, which the doctors went through, but the injury that they attributed to the accident that he had for resource drilling was a back strain, a lumbosacral back strain. And yes, I do take the position that this particular injury was not such to cause total and permanent incapacity. There are differing degrees of back strains and differing types of back injuries.
Well,
and we're just saying this is not one of those types that makes this man totally and permanently incapacitated.
You're limited to what the jury found unless there's no evidence to support it.
Yes, Your Honor. The other distinguishing factor in the cases that hold that a man can go back to work and still be found totally and permanently incapacitated is that in those cases there is direct evidence that the reason he went back to work or the reason this person went back to work was for economic reasons. And here we don't have any of that type of evidence. The evidence is he went back to work, he worked for the county of Zapata for 1 month because it was a temporary job, and he did his job fine. Dr. Swan knew this when he gave his deposition. And he said, yes, I understand he's going back to work. And I do take issue with the way the questions were phrased in the trial court. It is true that Mr. Gutierrez does, on two or three occasions, ask a very general question to Mr. Rocha first. Can this man perform the usual tasks of a worker? Mr. Rocha never answered that question because there was an objection. There was also a lengthy discussion concerning the objection. And after that lengthy discussion is when Mr. Rocha inquired of Mr. Gutierrez, are you asking me if he can work? And Mr. Rocha says, no, he can't. And a few pages later in the transcript, Mr. Rocha unequivocally admits that he had not seen Mr. Lerma since the day of the accident, and he really didn't know what this man could or could not do. Dr. Swan, on counsel cites page 62 of the record, Dr. Swan's testimony. Dr. Swan goes on page 74 of the record to say that Mr. Lerma, yes, when he came in, he was working, but he was improving enough, he had improved enough to go back to work. And I do take issue with whether or not we take the position that it was Dr. Swan's testimony that this man cannot perform heavy manual labor, and it was Dr. Swan's testimony that it was okay for this man to be working. He realized that Dr. Galo had encouraged this man to go back to work. The Court of Appeals opinion on page 7 specifically does list the type of evidence that it looked at in making the determination whether Mr. Lerma was totally and permanently incapacitated. And that evidence specifically states that he was limited from doing heavy manual labor, the work of an oil field worker.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May I be seated?
Yes. That concludes the argument. In the second cause, the court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.